It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Climate-related crises are not new, and as they become more frequent and more severe, it makes sense to recognize the teams that are literally flying into the eye of the storm at great risk to themselves to help feed thousands in desperate need. When the most powerful Atlantic storm in recorded history smashed into the Bahamas, an advanced team from World Central Kitchen was already there to start what they've done before, organizing and feeding the devastated population. From our Farm to Table Talk archives, here is a podcast conversation we published earlier with World Central Kitchen's Executive Vice President, Nate Mook.
Nate, I think the best place to start is explaining World Central Kitchen.
Sure. So World Central Kitchen is a nonprofit organization founded by Chef Jose Andres. And we work to respond to emergencies around the world where food is needed, where people do not have access to hot and fresh meals. And we also have long-term programs where we work to build food security, we work on clean cooking initiatives, and workforce development in the food industry. So those are our two kind of main areas of focus, our emergency relief work and our longer-term programs. And oftentimes those long-term programs will come out of our emergency relief work. And sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you, how did it come to be? I mean, you have so much to talk about, and it's such a broad range of programs you're into. But at one point, it didn't exist. So, you know, what triggered the establishment of World Central Kitchen?
Absolutely. So World Central Kitchen was founded in 2010 after the earthquake in Haiti. Chef Jose Andres, our founder, he was actually traveling in the Caribbean at the time. He was not in Haiti, but he was in the Caribbean for a big food festival, a food event, with a number of top chefs, and it was a pretty exclusive crowd, and he saw the terrible tragedy unfolding in Haiti after the earthquake. And, you know, he realized that while he was there feeding the few at this event, and while he says he feeds the few in his restaurants, you know, he sort of realized that there was this desire to bring his skills and expertise and experience to bear to try to feed the many. And so that was sort of the seed that got planted. A few weeks later, he ended up flying down to Haiti and started to learn, started to go into communities, started to help cook, started to see what the needs were, started to see what some of the challenges were. You know, and this was actually fairly novel, the idea of, you know, Jose, who's an entrepreneur, who's a businessman, who's a restaurateur, who's a chef, to sort of be dropped into an emergency relief context or development, you know, a development sector, and to try to, you know, basically just bring his background and knowledge and his approach to things. And that was the beginning. So he started small, looking at projects where he could, you know, kind of have an impact. And one of those was around clean cook stoves. So tried to change, the burning of charcoal, which is very bad for the environment and for the health of those who are cooking, and try to turn those to cleaner cook stoves. And that was the beginning back in 2010.
Now, when the hurricane, or was it an earthquake, I guess, in Haiti?
Yeah, it was an earthquake back in 2010.
Sorry. So when that earthquake hit and he was aware of it, did he have to contact some government agency and say, I want to come, or did he just buy a plane ticket and fly down there?
So he just bought a plane ticket and flew down. You know, he had reached out to some folks and at USAID and some other organizations to sort of, you know, be connected, you know, but in the chaos of these types of situations, oftentimes, it's too slow to sort of try to coordinate something and to try to go through, you know, a government sort of process. You know, he just wanted to get on the ground and see what could be done, and see what the needs were firsthand. So he just bought a plane ticket and flew down as soon as he could. And this was the same approach that he took back in 2017 when we flew to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria hit, which ended up being sort of the beginning of World Central Kitchen's relief work, our emergency relief work around the world, where we would start to go in immediately after, even before natural disasters and man-made disasters, to be able to support those who needed food.
Now, were you working with him then when Puerto Rico?
I was. So I got to know Jose in 2011, shortly after he founded World Central Kitchen. At the time, the organization was very small, had a few projects it was undertaking in Haiti, had a bakery, a social enterprise bakery that was created, an orphanage where the orphanage could start to produce its own bread, which was a very expensive commodity to purchase, could produce its own bread and then could sell the excess bread at the market, which would then feed back in to support the making of new bread. So it was a way of kind of sustaining much more economically a situation that was a real drag on the orphanage. And so that's when I got to know Jose in the early days, as he was beginning this work. And I was working in the development sphere as well, spending a lot of time traveling around the world and got a chance to go down to Haiti and see the work. And that's when we sort of got connected and started working together. But in a more full-time capacity, it really was Puerto Rico that was when I got drawn into World Central Kitchen in a more direct manner. And that was Jose was headed down to see what could be done in Puerto Rico. This was just a couple of days after Hurricane Maria had hit. The island had been devastated. The electrical grid was off. There's very little communications. We managed to get on one of the first commercially available flights down there. They had to navigate in via satellite phone because the towers, the radios on the towers weren't working, so all planes were using satellite phones to be able to coordinate and land. There were just a couple of planes, one or two flights that were landing per day. But we didn't really know what to expect. We hadn't gone there with a big master plan or a big agenda of what to do. We were only expecting to stay for about 3 or 4 days. Jose and I only brought a few pairs of clothes with us. But of course what we found on the ground was really, that Puerto Rico was on the brink of a humanitarian disaster. People did not have access to food. They didn't have access to, there was no electricity. There was very little water. People were obviously surviving on what they had already had in their homes for 2, 3, 4 days. But once you get past that, it's a real crisis, especially when you look at elderly populations and young kids. There really needs to be access to food. And so we did what chefs know how to do, which is we just started cooking.
Well, you get off a plane and you've got to show passports and get into some hotel somewhere. And then I suppose you have cell phones with you. Were they still working?
They weren't really working very well. There was very limited access to communications. You couldn't really make phone calls. We did have a satellite phone. But the first thing we did was really start to get connected. And even before we left for Puerto Rico, we got linked up with a number of local chefs who Jose had already known, restaurants, reaching out to connections on the ground. So we at least had sort of started to get a sense very quickly of what the situation was and what the needs were. The first kitchen that we activated actually was Jose Enrique, who was a good friend of Jose's. Jose Enrique was doing some sancocho, which is a kind of a Puerto Rican stew that was serving for the local community in the Santurce neighborhood of San Juan. And we went and visited Jose Enrique's restaurant and we said, you know what, we're just going to start here. We're just going to start small. We're just going to start, 1,000 meals a day to start and just start growing from there. And that's really, how we did it.
So you had to get on the phone, find people to bring meat and vegetables and potatoes. And then hopefully you had dishes and plates and tables and pots and pans and all these things. It just is amazing to me to think about, start putting that together. And then ultimately, from that kind of a beginning, how many people did you feed in Puerto Rico?
So we served close to 4 million meals in Puerto Rico over the time that we were there. And obviously in the early days, it was, you know, huge numbers. We had 21 kitchens activated. We were doing 150,000 meals a day at the peak, distributing to hundreds of locations around the island. And then as electricity started to come back on, as things started to recover, we then shifted our focus into the more isolated areas. And we continued to cook. We hit the ground in late September 2017, and we continued to cook all the way through the end of June 2018. So we continued the operation going. But like you said, you know, it was complex, but I think, you know, this is where the expertise of chefs in this industry really begins to shine. You know, Jose likes to say that, you know, if you look at, you know, medical emergencies around the world, who do you send in? Well, of course you send in doctors because they know how to respond to medical emergencies. And yet when we look at feeding emergencies around the world, we're often not sending the people that know how to feed people the best, who know how to cook and prepare the meals, who know how to get the ingredients, who know how to distribute those meals. And that's really ultimately all we did on the ground in Puerto Rico. You know, Jose and his background and expertise as a restaurateur and a chef, you know, the first thing we did was we went to one of the largest food distributors on the island. We didn't try to bring in a bunch of food from the outside, which had paralyzed the United States government response on the island. You know, we went after the food that was already there, and we said, you know what, we're just going to start buying it from the local distributors. Puerto Rico is an island of 3 million people. The food didn't disappear overnight. Just the ability to coordinate and transport and cook and prepare that food disappeared. And so what we did was we went to where the food was and start utilizing what resources were available there. And that's really been kind of the ethos of how World Central Kitchen responds both in the United States and around the world since, is we really look at the local resources that are available.
Well, how did you pay for this?
So, you know, in the beginning, it was on credit cards. It was, you know, on faith that, you know, we would start to, you know, gain support. We would get donations in from folks who could see the work that was being done. And ultimately, that's really what enabled this, was the small donations coming in from folks who saw the work that World Central Kitchen was doing, that wanted to do something to support their fellow American citizens during this time, but you know, didn't know how and didn't know the best approach. And so World Central Kitchen became an opportunity where in real time we were showing people every day, we were sharing photos and video, and people could see how many meals we were doing, where those meals were going, and there was this transparency to it that people could feel like they could be engaged and support. And so in the beginning it was trust and faith that, you know, we would figure it out, but you know, you can't wait to feed people who are hungry in hopes that you can, you know, you can try to raise some money first. We couldn't wait around and let people starve while we were hoping and searching for money. So we just started somewhere. We just started wherever we could.
Did other chefs in the mainland just say, come down and say, hey, can I help out somewhere? You know, give me something to peel or something to cook, right? You know, just let me help.
Absolutely. You know, that's really a hallmark, I think, of the way that World Central Kitchen operates as an organization now, is we have this incredible network of chefs that we've built up, and we have great partners like Bon Appetit Management Company, which is they work all over the United States, and they do corporate and they do convention centers and things like that. And they have teams of chefs that are really good at knowing how to cook for lots of people. So Bon Appetit sent down some chefs. Jose's own company sent down some chefs. We had other chefs that just wanted to volunteer in their own time, fly down to Puerto Rico. And that's been the case, you know, everywhere we've been since Puerto Rico, out in California during the wildfires, or in North Carolina when Hurricane Florence hit, or Florida when Hurricane Michael hit, you know, we are so grateful, and you know, and the work that we do really would not be possible without the incredible chefs and the community, this industry really coming together to support people in times of need.
You know, I tried to reach someone from World Central Kitchen, and I caught them working down just over the Mexican border, I think in Tijuana, when one of the caravans that there were, I don't know how many people there were, that all of a sudden showed up on the border and needed to be fed. And you guys were there. I thought, I can't imagine a disaster in the world that you're not able to be there fairly quick and up and running.
We're learning. We are a fairly young organization. I mean, World Central Kitchen has been around now for 9 years, although we've really only been doing this emergency relief work for the past year and a half in this method. But I think what we're showing is what's possible. And we've built a model where we can move very quickly, leveraging local resources, volunteers, support on the ground, finding, you know, existing supply chain, not trying to reinvent the wheel, not trying to bring everything in. So when we saw that there was this crisis brewing on our southern border, you had refugees coming up from Central America who had, you know, been fleeing violence and gangs and extreme poverty. And these are families that, you know, really just are trying to feed their children. There are amazing institutions in Tijuana that have long supported, those seeking asylum and those coming to the southern border legally to apply for asylum and other processes to enter the United States. But they were never really prepared for, say, 6,000 people to show up all at once. And so in Tijuana, you ended up with these really informal camps. You had families living in the cold. It actually gets quite cold there at nighttime. Living in these tents and these makeshift cities almost, on soccer fields and in abandoned, nightclubs and the infrastructure wasn't there to support them. And so families were going hungry. Children had nothing to eat. And so that's where an organization like World Central Kitchen can move very quickly, like a SWAT team, kind of get on the ground very fast, identify a kitchen, working with local partners and supports, and begin cooking fresh, healthy, and nutritious meals and make sure we can distribute them to those in need. And that's really become how we operate everywhere that we do. And we're kind of pushing the boundaries and learning as we go to see what we can do. Last year took us out to Indonesia, where we responded to three different disasters in Indonesia, including earthquakes and tsunamis. We were down in Guatemala after a big volcano eruption down there last summer. And we have a team right now that's out in Mozambique after this terrible cyclone has impacted over 2 million people there, destroyed, I think, hundreds of thousands of homes and devastated communities. And so we were able to get a team there on the ground. And right now we're the only organization that's providing hot meals to those who have been impacted by the cyclone in Mozambique.
Well, and you even had floods in Nebraska. I mean, the things are popping up all over the world. I can't imagine what your planning room looks like. It would seem like you would have, you know, a map of the world, and you'd have these hot spots that you kind of look at and say, wait a minute, I think we may be needed here. I mean, how do you track what's emerging as an area that might need your help?
So you're absolutely right. I mean, we have to keep a careful eye on everything that's going on around the world, both natural disasters like the flooding in Nebraska and man-made disasters like the refugees that are fleeing Venezuela into Colombia in the tens of thousands every day. So part of it is really identifying where the crises are happening, but also where there's a real need, where there's a gap, where there is potentially an urgent need that is going to take a longer time for the institutional organizations to address, say the groups like the World Food Program or the United Nations or more locally, say the American Red Cross. So where it's going to take longer for folks to be able to respond. So we can be in there quickly and fill those gaps. And so we look at those types of situations or until the local community itself can sort of stabilize to be able to support. Because, of course, the last thing we want to do is go in and be providing meals that are then taking away from, you know, say what a local restaurant or, you know, people will not go to the local grocery store. We have to be very cognizant of the local impact. So we're kind of always sort of assessing. We're kind of 24/7, we're in assessment mode. And we have a team that we call our advanced team, which will go into a location, go into a place, get on the ground, see what the needs are before we decide to say activate a full-on, you know, kitchen team and relief operation. But I will say, you know, at the end of the day, it is a bit chaotic, and we're kind of always, you know, always monitoring and always getting more, trying to get more and more prepared and managing teams that are in multiple locations at once. But, you know, if there's anybody that knows how to manage controlled chaos, I think it's hard to beat chefs, right? I mean, this is what they live in on a daily basis in a kitchen and how they operate. And so, you know, it's been amazing to see how, as we grow our team, you know, what a natural fit these types of skill sets are for being able to respond to disasters like this.
So do you keep a bag packed that's ready to go, that you know what's in your what's in your travel bag?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have go bags that we call them, and we also have kits that are you know, contain everything, kind of the core basics of what we need just to get on the ground and start moving you know, as quickly as possible. We're obviously prepared to be in situations where there's no communications, there may not be electricity, so we have, you know, obviously lights and solar chargers and satellite phones and, you know, and some things you need in kitchens as well. We have our kitchen equipment, things that might be harder to find in an environment, you know, that maybe you could find in the United States, but not internationally. And so we've got small kits that we can put on the plane as a checked bag that then can be utilized out in the field. Absolutely.
Well, chefs have to have their knives.
Exactly.
And so hauling them around everywhere. That's so you can just jump and go. And otherwise, you, I suppose there's not much need for you to pack a 3-piece suit and anything like that. Go pretty basic.
Exactly. Probably more waterproof gear than 3-piece suits. You know, it's especially, you know, when you deal with flooding or hurricanes and things like that, and you're out in the, you know, in the middle of it sometimes, you know, as we saw in North Carolina, you got to be ready for the water.
Well, you know, one of the man-made disasters in a way that you were in the middle of not too long ago is when the government shut down and you were actually feeding the kind of furloughed federal workers, weren't you?
We were, yeah. And, you know, that's a great example of a situation where we, you know, we really kind of waited to see if and when we were going to be needed. So we didn't immediately activate and get up and running and start feeding the federal workers on day one of the shutdown. A lot of amazing local businesses in the United States, here in Washington, D.C. and around the country, you know, were offering discounts or free meals to federal workers who showed their IDs. But, you know, the real sort of emergency started when folks missed their first paycheck, and then they started to miss, they went on and ended up missing their second paycheck. And, you know, I think as we've now realized, you know, this can be devastating. You know, these are full-time employees who have never had to worry about, you know, missing a payment. And, you know, this is not something that people are used to. And people in the United States, they you know, they don't have tremendous amounts of savings to just start to pull from when, you know, when something like this can happen unexpectedly. And so, you know, it was a real emergency that was happening in our own backyard. And I think a real symbol of this was when we opened up the kitchen here in Washington, D.C. As a first step. And the day before we opened it, we expected maybe to see about 2,000 people come through that entire day. And that was kind of on the high end. We thought maybe if we had 500 people come by for a free meal, that would be great. That first day, we saw 4,500 people come through the door. And the numbers continued to go up. And on our peak day, just out of this one kitchen in Washington, D.C., and this one cafe kitchen we were serving from, we saw about 11,500 people come through the door in one day. We served that many meals. And, you know, it was cold. I mean, it was 20 degrees outside, and it was frigid as the Arctic plunge was happening in January, and people were standing outside in line to get a hot meal for the first time in their life. I mean, this was reminiscent of the bread lines back during the Great Depression. I mean, it was shocking. And I think that if there's one positive that came out of this, and obviously it's a terrible situation that we wish would never be into in the first place, but if there's one positive, I think it's that we forced our federal government to visually see the impact that this was having on people. You know, this was not a partisan issue. This was an issue where our American citizens on all sides were suffering, and it's something that perhaps could, you know, that members of the administration, members of our government, sort of laughed about and couldn't understand why people would really be that affected. But it was undeniable. As you drove down Pennsylvania Avenue between the U.S. Capitol and the White House, and you saw a line of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people standing out in the cold for a free plate of food was shocking. And so I hope that it was a lesson that we'll never have to do it again. But I think, you know, I'm glad that World Central Kitchen was able to activate, because you're absolutely right. I mean, not all disasters are natural. You know, you can have man-made disasters, and not all man-made disasters happen, you know, in conflict areas or you know, in developing parts of the world, and they can happen right in our own backyard.
You know, in an event like that, what would have been the menu? What do you have for a protein of the side dishes for people?
Yeah, so pretty much everywhere we operate, you know, we sort of have the core things that we want to incorporate. We obviously want to incorporate that we've got fresh vegetables, we got fresh protein. So we'll have chicken, we'll have steak, we'll have pork, we'll have different options. We'll have a starch, so a rice or a mashed potato or roasted potatoes, and always have fresh vegetables. We always utilize a lot of fresh vegetables. We don't open things out of cans and dump them in and eat them up and serve them to people. No, we as an organization founded by a chef and operating in kitchens, we certainly, you know, use real food. We always make salads. Salads are key. You know, you got to have the fresh greens, you got to have fresh vegetables, fresh fruit with everything that we do. So even in the midst of a hurricane, we're distributing fresh fruit and salads out to shelters because it's so critical to have fresh food. So specifically with our Chefs for Feds operation, every day we had a different menu. So we changed it up every day. So it wasn't the same thing every day. We always had a sandwich or a bowl. And that would be, so we'd have various types of chicken sandwiches, or bowls. We'd always have a side salad option as well, or a soup. We had a lot of soup in Chefs for Feds because it was really cold in January. So a hot soup for folks was something that was key. So we always had that, and then always had a fresh piece of fruit and granola bars and things like that that we could hand out as well, so people could take them back to their offices, because many of the federal workers we were serving were actually essential employees who still had to go back to work every single day, even though they weren't getting paid. So, you know, we really try to make sure that we always have a complete balanced meal. Even in challenging situations, we want to make sure that people receive a healthy, nutritious meal, because, you know, and it's in those times of need that you really need it the most. And then we can adapt. I mean, if there's one thing chefs are good at is adapting with what we've got. So if we're in Florida and we have access to certain things, we can develop a menu based on that, based on the context of where we are. You know, what we serve in California is going to be very different from perhaps what we're going to serve in North Carolina, because you're going to have access to different ingredients, you're going to have different tastes, different needs. In California, for example, we found ourselves doing a lot of vegan and gluten-free meals. that wasn't necessarily a priority for a lot of folks in North Carolina, although certainly still request sometimes. So you just kind of have to balance things and look at, you know, different places, different needs, and create menus that are, you know, that are really gonna be something that are gonna not only nourish what we say is, you know, not only to nourish the body, but also to nourish the soul.
Do you get donations of food from farmers or councils or boards or government agencies that try to help supply you with what you're preparing?
We do. We do sometimes in limited quantities and circumstances. You know, certainly in California during the wildfires, we received a lot of fresh produce from farms. You know, when in late 2017 with the big Thomas fire in Ventura, California, that whole area is you know, just rife with agriculture and a lot of farms. And because businesses were shut down, restaurants were shut down, grocery stores were shut down, farmers ended up with a lot of extra produce that was going to go bad. So we worked with the both directly with the farmers and also with the local food banks that were receiving a lot of fresh food that they couldn't necessarily do anything with. So certainly in those cases, you know, it can sometimes be challenging because, you know, we do need reliability. We do need to know what we're going to have and that we're going to have enough of it. I mean, if we're preparing 20,000 meals one day, you know, that's going to require a lot of a certain type of an ingredient. And oftentimes that's out of scope of what necessarily can be easily donated. So we certainly do accept donations. We appreciate it, but it's really a very small portion of what we do. And the other challenge, of course, as well is when you're in these types of fast moving situations, you have to be very careful about safety, sanitation, the custodial chain of any sort of food. So, you know, the last thing we want to do is take food that maybe is being donated by, you know, despite, you know, we appreciate the thought behind it. But for example, if there's been food that, say, you know, being kept by a restaurant in a refrigerator and the restaurant has lost power and so they want to get rid of the food out of their refrigerator, we really can't take that because we don't know, you know, how long it was maybe sitting there when the power was off in their refrigerator, right? Like we have to make sure that we uphold the highest of standards when we're serving people. Just because it's a disaster doesn't mean we can cut any corners. And so we like to look at this, and what we say, and of course our chefs say, is that, you know, we look at folks, you know, imagine they're paying customers, right? You're not going to cut corners and serve them something below what you would normally serve them in your own restaurant. And so that's the only thing we have to take into consideration when we, you know, when we accept donations from anybody.
Nate, when you look down the road, say the next 5 years, what's next for World Central Kitchen?
So, you know, I think we're at the very early stages of showing what we can do and what's possible in this type of work. I think World Central Kitchen, what I like to say is sort of the second generation of World Central Kitchen, the WCK 2.0, started after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. That was sort of the next phase of the organization. And now as we're sort of gearing up to the 3.0 phase, I think it's really an ability to respond globally around the world, to be the, you know, the food organization that can be called upon. You know, that the U.S. Congress can call up Jose Andres and say, Jose, we've got, you know, this emergency. We need your teams to go and deploy and start cooking. And I think that's really kind of where we're headed. We want to continue to build our capacity. We want to build our teams. We want to continue to show what this industry is capable of doing. You know, I think we're going to continue to grow our core of chefs around the country and around the world. You know, and I think we really see ourselves, you know, being able to respond wherever we are needed, and also to change the expectations of what we should be serving folks in times of need. That, you know, MREs that are, you know, okay for military during conflict times are not what we should be giving folks in the aftermath of a hurricane. We shouldn't be giving them junk food boxes filled with potato chips and candy bars and Skittles. That this is not acceptable. That this is not food. And that I hope that by showing what's possible, we're going to start to shift the expectations that this is no longer going to be the, kind of the outlier, but is going to be the way that just things are done across the board. And, you know, just because Jose is involved, just because that, you know, he is a chef with a number of great restaurants and some Michelin stars behind his name, you know, this isn't about cooking gourmet meals. You know, we're not out there, you know, cooking for a few hundred people. I mean, we're showing that we can cook for tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, and deliver fresh, nutritious meals in times of need. And so, you know, in 5 years from now, I want to look back and sort of be able to kind of, you know, recognize that the tides have changed, that things have shifted, that we are able to respond to both domestically for our own citizens here in the United States, and also to support internationally, with meals in times of need. And this is just the way that things are done.
You know, Nate, I know that people are going to be jealous in a way of you because you're so enthusiastic. You're so into this. You're excited about it. And I'm sure the people around you are as well. If there are people listening that would like to figure out how they could help, maybe they want to come to work for you, or maybe they want to volunteer, or maybe they're a chef and they're saying, hey, tell me where I can buy a plane ticket to. How do they get in the loop with you so that they could try to be a supporter of your team?
Absolutely. So we couldn't do this work without incredible support from those that you know, are simply hear about our work and are the ones that really kind of make it happen, right? So, I mean, none of this would be possible without financial support and contributions. And so people can donate. I mean, even $25 can go a long way to making sure that people get a fresh hot meal after disaster. So any donation, financial contribution goes straight to food, to people in need. And that is a huge, huge help. We, of course, are growing our team of chefs around the world. So we encourage chefs who have the ability and who are interested in getting involved and volunteering their time to contact us, to reach out, on our website. They can email us. They can reach out to us on Twitter or Facebook and request to get involved and more information about how they can sign up as a chef. But you don't have to be a chef, right? I mean, we love having volunteers who can come down, and there's a lot to be done. There's chopping vegetables. There's making sandwiches. There's going and delivering food to people in need and going out in their communities. Not everybody has to be a trained chef in the kitchen. And so we love our volunteers who can get involved. In Puerto Rico, we saw probably around 20,000 volunteers come through over the time that we were there. And none of our work would have been possible without the incredible folks, you know, putting in the hard work every single day in and day out. And so volunteering is a great way to get involved. And even if you can't fly anywhere far, you know, we never know when the next thing is going to happen. And so just to be aware and to follow our work is a great way as well. So, you know, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, follow Jose. Keep up to date with what we're doing, and then reach out. We love to hear from folks. We love to get back to you and talk to you and see how you can support, this movement that we're building here.
We should mention a website.
Yes, worldcentralkitchen.org, or just WCK.org. WCK.org makes it simple.
And is there an email or something that info@that they could send and say, put me on the list or contact me if something comes up, or is there anything like that they could be proactive?
Absolutely. So they can shoot an email to hello@wck.org. That's just hello@wck.org. On the website, there's some information about, you know, different ways to reach out and contact. You can always send us a message on Facebook as well. If you don't use email, you can send us a reply on Twitter and reach out, or a direct message. And we try to get back to everyone. It might take a couple of days because we might be in the middle of some stuff, but you know, we certainly appreciate it and we'll absolutely get back to you.
Nate, it's a wonderful thing that you're doing with World Central Kitchen. I really appreciate your taking the time to join us on Farm to Table Talk to tell this wonderful story. And I'm sure we've got people listening to this podcast that are going to be in touch with you. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Roger. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.